Good evening. My name is Robert Stubblefield. I'm the director here at Texas Tech Junction, and I welcome everyone here for the Texas Water Symposium workshop this evening. We most certainly appreciate everyone to come in to listen to drought. Where's it going? When is it going to end? The irony of this situation is that prior to me coming in this evening, my dad had called me. He lives on the North Llano, or on the mainland, I should say. And I was getting ready to take the day off to go deer hunting tomorrow, and he says, "We don't have any water at the house. The well may have run dry." And we know we've got water out there, but for those of you out here that know Olin Riley, he's going to be out there tomorrow to see if we can get back into the water business again out there. It's a very serious issue, and we most certainly appreciate everyone coming in today to listen to our distinguished panelists today. That being said, Dr. Asufi, would you be so kind as to introduce our panel? Thank you. Thank you for attending.
I want to thank everybody for coming today. I think we've got a really interesting topic, and more so we have a really dignified expert panel to educate us about what drought is and what the impacts are and what we can look forward to and maybe what we can do about it. I want to preface a couple of comments before I introduce the first speaker. Back in 96, I had organized what was called the Ed Cape Seminar, and I had Judge Bunton, Lucius Bunton, come and give the talk, and he was the judge that presided over the Sierra Club lawsuit associated with the Edwards Aquifer. And the title of his talk was "Texas Water Law During Times of Drought, Is It Adequate?" That was back in 96 that he gave that talk. And one of the things that he did was he had me looking for an old song. And the song had a title that went something like, "The Times They Are A-Changing." And I think what we're going to hear today is that times are a-changing, and what can we look forward to? So one of the guys that are going to show us the way is John Nielsen Gammon. He's an American meteorologist and climatologist and professor of meteorology at Texas A&M University. He's also the Texas State climatologist, holding both appointments since 2000. His research groups use a combination of observational, computational techniques to study the characteristics, dynamics, and forecasting of weather phenomena. Much of Dr. Nielsen Gammon's recent work has involved air pollution meteorology. John?
Thank you. I was appointed state climatologist in 2000 by Governor Bush. I think I'm the last surviving Bush appointee within the government. That's mainly by not doing anything important. For the first 8 years or so of my job, when I'd tell people I was Texas State climatologist, the overwhelming response was, "I didn't know we had a state climatologist. What's a state climatologist do?" Now the situation is completely different. I tell them I'm state climatologist, they ask me, "When's it going to rain?" And I'm here to tell you the answer is eventually. The how, what, when, where, why part, I can tell you when it started, which was actually down to the day. September 27, 2010 was the last major storm system to come through the state in September. Then October was a drier than normal. November was drier than normal. January was about normal. March was the driest March on record. Last 6 months since March have each been among the 10 driest on record for those months. So we just completed statewide, approximately 11.1 inches of rainfall over the past 12 months, which is about 2.5 inches below the previous record, which was set in 1956. You may have heard of that drought year. And it's about 40% of the normal rainfall for a year. So by all measures, this is the most severe one-year drought on record for the state of Texas. Now, we actually knew going into the winter of 2010 that it was going to be probably a drought year, and that was because of a phenomenon called La Niña, which you've probably heard about. It's when the temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean are cooler than normal. And it's a little bit of a stretch to say, well, of course we're dry. The temperatures in the tropical Atlantic are cooler than normal. What's going on with that? Well, the connection is with the thunderstorms in the tropics. They're basically part of the big engine that drives the weather for the entire globe. You've got air rising and the thunderstorm activity then spreading out and sinking. It's heating up the atmosphere as the convection occurs and really affects the whole temperature pattern for the globe. When the tropics are cool, there's less of a temperature gradient from the tropics to mid-latitudes, so the winds are weaker, the subtropical jet stream is weaker, and we get less storm systems in the wintertime because there's not a jet stream at our latitude to carry them across us. The storms miss us to the north. They go across the northern United States. Precipitation is either you're lucky or you're not sort of deal. There's going to rain somewhere. It's just a matter of where it gets distributed. And with a La Nina event, the rain is primarily in the northern part of the United States, and the southern part of the United States is the part that gets unlucky. Now, each La Nina year is different. We get a La Nina year maybe about 2 or 3 years out of every 10, and they're interspersed with El Nino, which is the opposite. It's when the temperatures are warm in the Pacific and we get rain and everybody's complaining about the rain we're getting rather than complaining about the rain we're not getting. So it's a cycle that sort of reverses itself every 2 or 3 or 4 years. If you're lucky, you get a La Nina followed by an El Nino, and a dry year gets followed by a wet year. This time around, we're looking at one La Nina being followed by another. Tropical Pacific Ocean sort of warmed up during the springtime and got back to normal around June. But then in August, it started cooling off again. And all indications from observations and from models are that we're likely to have another La Nina event this wintertime. It's already cold enough to qualify for La Nina conditions. All we need is for it to last another month, and it'll become official. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit because that sort of explains why it was dry during the wintertime. It doesn't explain why it was so dry because, of course, we've had La Ninas before, about 2 or 3 years out of 10, our La Nina years. And maybe about 80% of the time, we have statewide below normal precipitation on average. About one La Nina out of five, we get lucky and are wetter than normal. But never before have we been so dry for so long. The period of time, October through March, was about the fourth driest on record. And then it kept going. And I think it's going to be a subject of research as to why things got so dry and stayed so dry for so long. Possibilities, maybe it was just the specific pattern of temperatures that made things particularly bad for Texas, that made us the center of ground zero for drought. Usually there's some variations in the weather. There's waves that move across the Pacific Ocean and the convection that changes the location temporarily. Or we get storms that depart from the standard jet stream pattern and dip across the southwestern United States and bring us relief. The strange thing this spring was we never really got that relief. We were locked into a weather pattern that kept the storm systems to our north, kept the winds relatively dry and blowing fairly strongly. About the only good aspect of that was not only were the storm stories, but so were the tornadoes. It wasn't good for the Mississippi River Valley in terms of the serious tornadoes that occurred there, but at least we missed most of the severe weather this spring. Unfortunately, you really can't have rain in the spring without severe weather, and conversely, if we don't get any severe weather, we're also likely not to get much rain. Okay, that takes us to the summer, when the influence of La Nina or El Nino is relatively weak in the United States because no longer is the jet stream important. The jet stream moves north every year, and we don't get any of these cold fronts coming through. We can go 2 or 3 months at a time without seeing a decent cold front during the summer. But what happens is the dry conditions that we experience within within Texas can get locked into place. So something that we call a feedback mechanism. If it starts off dry, there's less water to evaporate, which means there's less moisture in the air, which means it's harder to form thunderstorms, which is our main source of rain during the summertime. So we get less rain, and so the ground gets even drier because we're continuing to have below normal rainfall. And then conversely, any solar energy that doesn't go into evaporating water goes into generating heat. It heats up the ground. The ground heats up the air. And if we get a dry summer, we also get a hot summer. So it's not really a surprise that because this summer was the driest on record, it was also the warmest on record. When the first preliminary numbers came into the National Climatic Data Center, the average temperature June through August statewide was 86.8 degrees Fahrenheit, which was warmer than any previous summer recorded in any state in the United States. It broke a record set by Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl. And in fact, Oklahoma was warm this year. They're in the same drought we are. They had, according to preliminary numbers, 86.7 degrees, one-tenth of a degree cooler than us. Then some more observations have come in from climate observers, and right now Oklahoma is actually running warmer than we are. But I think that will change because a lot of the climate reports come in by paper. And driving over here, went through Johnson City, and I think we Texans know something about sending in some extra paper evidence to tilt the election in our favor. And so we may very well end up, when things come out, with the hottest summer on record. At least it's either going to be the hottest or second hottest. So here we are, after the driest 12 months ever, looking at another dry winter. And probably dry spring as well. And then will we get thunderstorm activity in the summer? Not if we stay dry. We've got such an enormous deficit to make up in terms of rainfall. The soil conditions through most of the state are bone dry, as far down as you can dig. There's tree mortality going on all over the place. So the scary part is whether this drought might actually last more than 2 years. Some of the sea surface temperature patterns don't change as rapidly as El Niño and La Niña do. They actually hang around for decades at a time. There's a Pacific Ocean pattern that stays around for a couple decades, then reverses itself. Right now, it's in the pattern that leads to dry conditions in the United States, southern United States, based on past record and based on computer models. In the Atlantic, temperatures are unusually warm. They've been warm since about 1995. And you might all know this because of the active hurricane seasons that we've had since 1995 that have been caused by the warm temperatures. Well, it turns out that the warm temperatures in the Atlantic apparently reduce our precipitation as well because it moves the thunderstorms away from land, moves them offshore over the warm water, and cuts off some of the moist air that comes into the Texas across the Gulf Coast. So right now, both the Atlantic and the Pacific are effectively working against us in terms of favoring dry conditions across the southern United States. This has happened, this situation has been in place since about the year 2000. And we've seen major droughts in 2005 and 6, 2008 and 9, and now 2011. And in between, we were lucky to have some very wet years. 2007 was one of the wettest years on record for Texas. 2010 was reasonably wet. We got lots of tropical rain from that. The last time both the Pacific and the Atlantic were tilted against us was in the 1950s and early 1960s. And I think we all know that the 1950s drought was the drought that is the benchmark for all droughts in Texas. Depending on where you were, is whether it started back in 48 or 1950 or 51. And except for a few floods in between, it lasted until 1957. So, and we also know from looking at past records that this area has received multi-year droughts, even decade-long droughts, even one drought that lasted a quarter century over the history that we can observe through tree rings. So we know a long-term drought is possible. We're going to be susceptible to drought as long as these ocean conditions are in place. I can't tell you how long they'll be in place. Based on past track records, maybe another 2 or 3 years, maybe another 10 or 15 years. It's impossible to say at this point. Technology is improving. In a few years, we'll be able to make forecasts of the ocean and be able to give you some more concrete answer about how long the situation will last and whether it's going to be a few more droughts interspersed by some recharge with rainfall events, or whether we might be unlucky enough to have a long-term drought. Can't say. I think the odds of a five-year drought at this point are maybe about 1 in 5, so really not likely to happen, but it's something that unfortunately we have to keep in the back of our mind as a distinct possibility, one that has occurred before and may occur again. With that, I think I'll close.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Bruce McCarl. He's Regents Professor of Agricultural Economics at Texas A&M University. Received bachelor's degree at University of Colorado and doctorate from Pennsylvania State University. His recent research efforts have largely involved policy analysis in climate change mitigation, water economics, and biosecurity, as well as proper application of quantitative methods to such analyses. Dr. McCarl teaches graduate courses in applied mathematical programming, applied risk analysis, and was part of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. McCarl.
I'm one of the research guys that normally hides in the back at A&M, so I'm here talking about some work done for some others. I desperately tried to get out of this, but Tom wouldn't let me. So let me talk a little bit about the effects of drought. Now, the losses from drought, and I'm principally going to talk on agriculture. The losses from drought basically manifest themselves in two different ways. There's losses to current agriculture, and our Extension Service has been working hard to develop some estimates, which I'll talk to you about in a second. And then there's some losses to future agriculture. Now, these losses accrue in several different ways. Lower yields is one of the more obvious ones in terms of lower yields in grazing with lower stocking rates and then lower yields from crops. We also see higher costs where people are spending a lot more money for feed and in certain areas quite a bit more money for applying irrigation water. The third manifestation is in terms of lower sale prices, where I don't actually follow these markets from day to day, but I assume calves are getting lower prices and animals are at lower prices, and then higher input costs in terms of higher costs of feed. Now, the Texas Extension Service has written a report where they tried to estimate what the costs were of the drought. You can find that report if you go to Google and search for AgriLife Today Drought and Billion, billion being the operative monetary term. Their estimate is that this year's losses are $5.2 billion, and that's up from a 2006 record of $4.1 billion. This is about 28% of the average value of agricultural production during the last 2 years. So we've lost roughly a quarter of the value of agriculture. And these are short-run estimates only. They don't include some of the longer-run adjustments that might happen. These estimates, they broke down by category, livestock being the big loser at $2.06 billion, cotton is second at $1.8 billion, hay at $750 million, corn at $300 plus million, wheat at $250, and sorghum at about $60 million. Notice that list didn't include losses to fruit and vegetable producers, horticulture and nursery crops, and some other possible grain and row crops. So that estimate is conservative because these other things are losing. And also, by the about 20 dead trees in my yard at home, I think there's a loss in terms of the forestry industry as well. They're also conservative in another direction in that they ignore the long run. So when I talk about the long run costs, John, when I wrote this, I didn't know what the heck he was going to say. He lives a quarter of a mile from me on the other side of campus, and I see him religiously once every 3 years, I think. So he said it could persist for some time. If that's true, then producers undoubtedly are going to increase risk management. And as many of us know, if you diversify a portfolio so it bears less risk, it generally also is slightly lower returning. So when people start doing risk management things, often they're sacrificing some returns. We'll likely see several kinds of increases in risk management. One's investments. We have a faculty member at A&M who has a farm up near Plainview somewhere, and he says his irrigation system won't put water on fast enough, and he's discontinued irrigating the corners. Well, the question is he going to spend a bunch of money and put in bigger pumps and pipes? Some people probably will. Some people may well invest and keep more in the way of backup feed supplies. If so, there's going to be inventory costs in that. To that. Also, up in the High Plains, faster aquifer depletion. If you go and you drill the new well for your parents' place, then perhaps you'll end up drawing that water down faster than you ordinarily would have. We also expect to see some changes in enterprises. In cropping agriculture, corn is the heaviest water user just about, although hay's up there in some cases pretty well too. We may see more corn and sorghum, which may be slightly less profitable, but use a little bit less water and also are a little more drought tolerant. There may be substantial losses in the breeding herds where people are getting rid of some of their current capacity, and it's going to take some time to rebuild that. Certainly lower stocking rates. If you drive around College Station, Texas, you can't really hardly see a cow anymore, and any that are surrounded by big piles of hay. There's no grass left. So in future years, there may be substantially less cattle, less irrigated land in some areas if the water is getting more dear. A land use change, potentially irrigated to dry land if the water is somewhat depleted, dry land to range where we may go and have more livestock, and then lower stocking rates on cattle. We also are likely to see lower input purchases where people are buying more from local distributors. The AgriLife did another study where they tried to take a look at what happened to local industry, and this blew that $5.2 billion direct loss up to an $8.7 billion loss by the time you consider the fertilizer dealers, elevators, processing plants, grocery stores, etc. And there's a reference in this PowerPoint. There's a paper by Bridget Guerrero called The Impact of Agricultural Drought Losses on the Texas Economy, where this is detailed. Now, finally, since I do climate change, so does John, but he didn't even mention it, I thought I should just say a little bit about climate change. Over the last 150 years, we've seen a substantial warming. In the last 25 years, the rate of that warming has been about four times faster than it was over the last 150 years. Last year was the warmest year ever on record in North America, and maybe the globe. Was it on the globe? I think it was second on the globe. We have seen a substantial increase in temperature and atmospheric carbon dioxide. When I got into this business in 1985, the atmospheric parts of carbon dioxide were about 340. this year, that it just a month or two ago, they were at 395, which means we went up 50 parts on a base of 340, about two parts a year. This is apparently a lake of carbon dioxide about the size of the Gulf of Mexico that we put in principally from power. There's no indication that's going to stop. Our usage of fossil fuels and coal has been exploding and will continue to explode on a global scale, which means that one of the forcing factors behind these increasing temperatures is likely to continue. So this being the warmest summer on record is probably not entirely unexpected, because in most of the historical data, 18 to 20 of the warmest years we've ever experienced have been in the last 20 years. And that's been running that way for about 20 years, hadn't it? I mean, every year it's just hotter and hotter. So the question to me a little bit is this the new normal? I mean, I don't think we're at the new normal yet, but on the other hand, we're more likely to be hot in the future as opposed to dropping back to temperatures we had 40 years ago. Now, under climate change, a bunch of the projections in the IPCC are that heat waves will be more intense, more frequent, and longer lasting. General decreases in precipitation in the subtropics. Texas is in the subtropics. Longer periods between rainfall events, greater risk of drought, and poleward shifts of storm tracks. A lot of these things sound like the kinds of things that happened this year, although it's not at all a wise idea to take 1 year and say, climate change is happening. But the thing that I find kind of compelling is when this is happening over 25 years and we just see a continual warming trend there. The final comment that I'll make, or final thing I'll talk about here, is what is projected in terms of rainfall over the period. There was a study done that's done in the southwestern United States. It's pretty much an area that goes straight north from Houston up into Colorado and then over to the California coast. And in that area, the projection is by 2080 that average conditions will be about as dry as what we have right now. So the real question is, will that be the new normal? Now, there's some evidence that this may not be the case. I mean, John argues we've been getting wetter, not drier, although most of the climate models sort of agree on this dryness. This is the average across 20-some climate models, 19 climate models here. The issue then is there is some chance by the end of the century that this will be the new normal, and I think one of the challenges is we need to begin to plan how to adapt to potential hotter and potential drier conditions so that we can manage some of that risk. So with that, I am done.
Our next panelist is John Backus, who recently joined the faculty at Texas Tech University as a professor in the Department of Natural Resources Management and as a wildlife ecologist. Previously at Texas State University, he was a Regents Professor, University Distinguished Professor, recognized as Robert B. Packard Distinguished Educator by the Southwestern Association of Naturalists, and Outstanding Educator by the Texas Chapter of the Wildlife Society. John's got numerous publications, grants, and was director of the Wildlife Ecology Graduate Program. He's generated over $7 million in grants in management of Texas wildlife and birds. John?
Certainly we realize that drought has consequences, but there's also for wildlife management some opportunities whenever we have droughts similar to what we have today. When we address wildlife, we generally address wildlife with respect to limiting factors. And there's three limiting factors that generally we discuss concerning wildlife, and this is food, cover, and water. And certainly water is the issue tonight, so I'm going to dwell primarily in the area of water. Systems do not work without precipitation. And certainly we realize that by observing just the landscape as we see it today. The important part of this precipitation for wildlife, in many cases, is that it produces plants, which is going to be that food component of limiting factors. Some wildlife species need standing water as a source of water. Others depend on succulents, which occurs within some of the plants that they eat. And whenever we have a lack of precipitation or a drought situation, then this succulents is not present in many of the plants as they begin to dry up and as they begin to die. Another factor that comes into play, which is very important with respect to drought, is that drought changes the carrying capacity of the land. As the land begins to change under the pressures of drought and lack of precipitation, plants begin to die, plants begin to wilt, the food resource begins to diminish for wildlife. And as a result then, this carrying capacity or the number of animals that a habitat will support begins to change. Therefore, what used to be a habitat that supported a given number of animals is now diminishing in its ability to support those animals. And what we see then is natural selection begins to take effect. And drought actually becomes then a source of natural selection for animals. Natural selection generally is a mechanism that controls the populations of animals. In this respect, then, drought reduces the productivity or the reproductive capacity of animals. We see that as less food is available for females, then females begin to have problems with energy allocation, especially when it comes to the point of producing offspring. Producing offspring is a high energy allocation process. If an animal is stressed from a lack of food, then there has to be physiological choices that are made by the system of that animal. It can either allocate energy to the survival of that animal, or it can allocate energy to the production of offspring. It cannot do both at the same time and survive. And so natural selection then becomes very important to the females of the population and to the young. And as a result then, drought begins to impact upon the population of turkey, quail, deer, whatever animals that we may be wanting to discuss. Some animals are better equipped to survive this drought situation, but many of our game species are impacted severely by drought. So as we look at these animals under these drought conditions, then we see malnutrition beginning to take place. It's very easy. Go out and look at the deer herd right now, and you'll see lots of ribs. You'll see declining body size. You'll see declining overall structure of the animals. So malnutrition is a forecursor of death, which is going to happen if this drought continues. Robert was telling me today they've been seeing dead deer here on the area, and that's not unusual for this part of the country. What happens then is drought becomes a mechanism for controlling the population of animals. And as a result then, if you no longer have a carrying capacity that will support a given number of animals, then death is going to be the mechanism that is going to bring that population to the carrying capacity of that habitat. Another factor that enters in the natural selection that's taking place during drought is that competition for resources becomes keener. if you have a pie and you want to get your proportion of that pie, then you want a smaller number of individuals wanting a piece of that pie also. Whenever you get into a drought condition and you have more individuals competing for a limited resource, then there is less food, less water available to the populations of animals that live in an area. And so this competition is another driving force leading to changes in the population of those animals. For fish, we have drought also becoming important. Certainly we have reduced stream flow. This is very important for those fish that live in smaller sized streams. As those streams begin to flow up or begin to form holes, water holes within the stream, eventually there's going to be problems for those animals. Another factor that comes into play is a reduced oxygen level that will be in those pools of water. And as the temperature begins to increase, as it did this summer, I know in San Marcos we had something like 90 days of 100-plus degrees, 100 or 100-plus degrees. As that water begins to heat up, it dissipates the oxygen from the water. And as a result, then, you'll have die-offs taking place. And then, as we look at the landscape, where plants are dying, you have more bare ground. Whenever you have a substantial rain, you get siltation into the stream, which is another problem for many of the smaller fishes. So we see there are certainly many consequences for wildlife during these periods of drought. But there's also some opportunities that are associated with drought. One of these is that we can change the way we manage land. And my suggestion is that since droughts, as our other panelists have already noted, are somewhat common, we need to manage for drought. Instead of managing for a maximum number of animals, maximum number of deer, for example, we need to be managing for a population of deer that is going to be able to survive a drought without these physiological problems that we've just mentioned. And so generally, if we're looking at carrying capacity as a standard as to what the population should be, we actually should be managing that population for about one-half carrying capacity. And that way, our animals are going to be able to survive a drought and survive a drought in a healthier condition than what we see at the present time. And so in managing this population for drought, we need to concentrate on managing habitat, providing primarily a good assortment of native plants, which are the primary food for most of our wildlife species. We need to manage our populations so that whenever droughts do occur, they'll be able to survive. So, yes, there are major consequences that are involved with droughts, but there are also opportunities. And so as you, especially in the area of deer management, as you look at your deer this year, this is the time to cull your herd, because the genetics in that population are going to be amplified in a drought type or a highly stressed type situation. So this year, your spikes and your poor antler deer are going to be outstanding within the population. Those deer that are 6 or 8 point this year are your keepers. Those are the animals that you want breeding, because these are the animals that have good genetics. This has been shown by studies at the Kerr Wildlife Area, in which we have deer that exist in a population that are called swing deer. In years whenever we have good habitat conditions, we have precipitation, good habitat, those deer might have good antlers, but they won't this year. And so here's an opportunity for, if you're trying to manage for a quality herd, then this is the time to cull your herd. So consequences and opportunities are always there, but they're certainly amplified during the time of drought.
Our last panelist is Todd Votler. Todd served as the federal special master for the U.S. District Court in Midland in the Sierra Club versus San Antonio Endangered Species Act litigation over the Edwards Aquifer. A Texas native, Dr. Votler has a Ph.D. in environmental geography from Texas State University and is a frequent contributor to popular publications on the Edwards Aquifer and other Texas water issues. He's also editor-in-chief of the Texas Water Journal and executive manager of intergovernmental relations and policy for the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority. Todd?
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to talk a little bit about a tree ring study that we just recently completed at the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, and which was done in cooperation with the University of Texas and the University of Arkansas Tree Ring Lab. But before I talk about that, I just wanted to mention that a few days ago we had some rain, and I don't know if you had as much here as we had in the watershed above Canyon Reservoir, which is the main water supply reservoir for our region, for the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority. But the flow in the Guadalupe River finally started again after 79 days of consecutive zero inflow to the reservoir. And so we finally got a little water coming in the reservoir, and now it's almost, you know, the trickle is almost diminished again. It's just above 6 cubic feet per second. It's normally about 230. And so we did get a little rain, but it didn't affect the storage in the reservoir much. Now we're releasing 72 cubic feet per second for the downstream needs on the Guadalupe, and there are some withdrawals taking place directly from the reservoir, so that the capacity of the reservoir right now is about 82%, which there are a lot of people who would really love to have 82% in their reservoirs out in West Texas right now. And so we're in pretty good shape. There are many reservoirs, especially the ones you hear a lot about are the reservoirs on the Colorado that are down around the 40% level, and you know, we're looking at another year of drought. Well, with that in mind, the state recovered from the drought of record in part by trying to figure out how they were going to deal with another one. And so we went about planning for the next drought of record beginning in the first water plan in 1961 and subsequent plans, and the state started to build reservoirs. And so we got to the 1980s, and we had built up a cushion of water supply that was supposed to get us through another drought like the 1950s drought. Well, that's about the time we stopped developing new water supplies, major new water supplies. And it's also about the time that the real increase in people moving to the state of Texas began. So at the time that our cushion was evaporating, you know, people were really kind of flowing into the state. And it's interesting to think about that, because it was not but a few years ago that some folks in water resource management here in Texas started talking about the drought in the 50s, 47 to 57, whatever, and saying, you know, that's an aberration, and it's too expensive to plan for a drought like that. And so we started to get very nervous. And one of the things we started to tell people was, well, look, don't listen to that. That's a little bit like saying, you know, I live on the coast, and I'm going to plan for a Category 1 hurricane, and that's all I need to do. And clearly, you know, that can lead to some real problems. So with that in mind, the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority decided, let's go ahead and take a more in-depth look at what droughts looked like in the past in this part of the world. I mean, there are tree ring studies and other things like that, but most of those studies are based on information from trees that are in New Mexico and far west Texas and over near the Texas-Louisiana border. Let's see if we can find something in our area, immediate area, older trees that we can try to reconstruct the drought cycle. And so, ironically, 2 years ago when I was here, I guess it was 2 years ago, started talking about we're getting ready to do this study and can't wait to get after it. And so I can tell you that we finished it now, and I'll talk to you a little bit about the results. Let me just say that we have instrumental records, you know, rainfall records from gauges that people have been collecting. They go back about 150 years. And we thought, well, you know, can we find trees in this part of the world that will help us push our knowledge of past routes back 300 years or more? And a number of the folks who do this kind of work, dendrochronologists, were telling us, well, you're not going to find any trees in Central Texas that are over 300 years old. It's just a waste of time. Don't even try. And then you know, finally found one who I convinced, well, you know, there might be some trees out there, we think, you know, that are pretty old. Why don't you come down here and help us take a look? And then we told, and you know, his idea initially was he was going to get in a canoe with a graduate student and paddle down all the rivers in Central Texas and get out wherever he wanted and take an increment borer and drill into a tree and get a sample. And I told him, well, you know, you can't really do that in Texas. I know that you can do that in some other states. That's all private property, and we've got to talk to people, make sure that you can go sample their trees. And as soon as I told him that, I thought the study was off because they said, oh, they're never going to let you come sample your trees. Well, we were very pleased that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department made available to us their properties to go out and look for bald cypress trees. You know, bald cypress trees can live to be 1,000 years old, some older than that, that have been sampled in various places. And we thought, you know, there are a lot of bald cypress trees here in Central Texas. Let's go out and see how old they are and what we can find out from them. So that's exactly what we did. And really, it was... one way to describe this is it's kind of like a scavenger hunt. And I had to go try to find areas that had a large number of bald cypress trees. I got a lot, and I did get a lot of calls from people who were really well-intentioned and said, I have a tree in my backyard. I want you to drive out here and sample it. But see, the really old bald cypress trees, 90% of them or so have heart rot. And so you drill into them and there's nothing in the center except mush. And it's the stuff in the center, the oldest information, as you drill into the through the layers of the tree and get to each ring older and older and older to the center, that you get the great information. And the great information we're looking for here is narrow and wide rings, using that pattern to reconstruct past climate. A wide ring, that's a wet year, and so the tree grows more. A narrow ring, that's a dry year. And if you take that pattern, you can actually reconstruct past droughts down to the exact year. So it can be very accurate. So anyway, we set about finding places where we could sample trees, and some of these trees were enormous. And one of the things I learned very quickly is the size of the tree tells you nothing about the age. We had some very old trees. This tree, for example, which only people who are here with us today can see, it's about, I don't know, it's as big as a small car, something like that. It's a young tree. It's less than 200 years old. You know, some of these big trees, they're just in a spot that they like. And they've got a lot of water, and they've got the right soil conditions and things of this nature, and so they just grow very quickly. So that made it a lot tougher because, you know, We couldn't just drive up to an area that had bald cypress trees and say, oh, let's go sample the big ones. Those must be the old ones. And if you're a bald cypress tree and you're living in the waterway, it's a tough life over the hundreds of years that you exist, with floods sending all sorts of debris, mostly your fellow brethren trees, down the stream course and battering you over time. And so, bald cypresses, if they're in the stream course, they have a kind of a hard life there. But the good thing is those trees recover very quickly from wounding. You know, something hits them, and they can recover from that quickly. And that's one of the reasons why we can take a sample out of them, and it doesn't hurt the tree. Actually, if you do it at the beginning of the growing season, you go back at the end of the growing season, you might not even be able to find the hole. So we went all over Central Texas and ended up with a couple of really good sampling sites. We went to some 8 different sites where we sampled a number of trees, 300 trees approximately, and took 800 core samples out of those trees. And we came up with some very interesting results, which I'm going to give to you now. And let me just say one thing else about that. The oldest tree we found was a sapling in 1426. So the folks who said you're not going to find any old trees, you know, clearly that was wrong. We've sampled a number of trees that we think were probably saplings in the 1300s, but they had heart rot. So if you can think about it, it's almost like going to a library and finding a really old book, and you get right to the center of it, and a moth flies out or something. You know, that information's lost. But we did have enough information to figure out what the climate has looked like, particularly with regard to droughts in this part of the world. You know, is the drought of record, the 47 to 57 drought, an aberration or not? The 4 sites we ended up using, one's on the San Bernard River, one's up near Lake Travis, another one is over on the Guadalupe near the Guadalupe River State Park, which is a parks and wildlife park, and then we had another site which was over near Wimberley. And so I can tell you that the drought of record, the 50s drought, was definitely not an aberration. And as a matter of fact, the 50s drought was, you know, maybe not even the worst of the 10-year droughts that we've seen over the last 500 years. And that's kind of a scary thought if you had lived through that drought and seen how devastating it was. And you've seen the reports from the impacts of that drought. So, you know, the 50s drought not being the worst over the worst of those 10-year droughts over the last 500 years is really sobering. If you look at the worst single-year droughts or worst 5-year droughts or so, you find a pattern that shows that the early 1700s were a really bad time to live in Texas. And I'd say that if you had a choice, you wouldn't have wanted to have been here from 1697 to 1716, because that was an awful time. It seems like it almost didn't rain during that period. I'm sure it rained a little bit, but the trees really suffered during that time. And the conclusions of this research, you know, are pretty interesting. We look at 1956, you know, 1956, a year almost as bad as this one. This one's a worse year than 56, but if you looked at 1956 and compared it to the other years over the last 500 years, you find that it was probably the 35th driest. And, my assumption was that, 1956 was going to be, the top 5 or something like that. So that puts that year into a little context that we can use going forward when we're trying to plan for future droughts. And that's maybe one of the messages of this study, is that, yes, the 10-year drought from 47 to 57 is the kind of drought that we need to make sure we're prepared for. But, you know, clearly there are worse droughts. And so the question comes to mind, you know, are we really at least thinking about, you know, how we might handle a drought like that? And, you know, so far, you know, we're really challenged to prepare for another drought like the 47 to 57 drought. And the state water plan, which is now being finalized and is going to be coming out here in the next few months officially, you know, shows that by 2060, if we don't do something, you know, we're going to have substantial deficit during another severe long-term drought like the 47 to 57 drought, and the impacts to the state, both economically and ecologically, will really be devastating. So it's going to be interesting to see whether, first of all, this year is kind of a wake-up call to people. You know, we don't really have the ability to finance water projects that we've got, you know, a planning process, and we come up with detailed plans. The problem is getting the projects built. The federal government is no longer investing in those projects like they were in the 60s and 70s and during those decades. And so, you know, much of that is now up to us. And so one of the major challenges is not just going to be planning what we need, but figuring out how we're going to finance it. And so far, we've not come up with a solution for that problem. And so that's the good news. thank you.
How about another round of applause for our great panel? Thanks.